Democrats are at an inflection point. On the one hand, they're coming off of an unprecedented win in special elections all across the country since 2018, including their most recent win in a New York special election for a hotly contested congressional seat. However, polling data would suggest that most of these wins are being driven by Democrats overperforming partisan turnout, meaning that their base is really coming out, not necessarily that they're persuading potential Republican voters. Under the Biden administration, Democrats have ushered in huge pieces of bipartisan legislation. Huge. The bipartisan infrastructure deal, the CHIPS Act, they have a lot of really positive things to run on. However, Biden's approval rating has just fallen through the floor. And special counsel Robert Hur's report on the president's handling of classified information while out of office includes multiple descriptions of his poor memory and describes him as a well-meaning elderly man, which could be politically damaging in the upcoming presidential campaign, which means that one of the most successful Democratic presidents in recent history could also usher in a second term of President Trump. And the result is a lot of hand-wringing. Democrats are very, very nervous right now. They're an anxious group to begin with, but right now it's a real fever pitch. But some Democrats think that the party is actually positioned to win. And one of those Democrats is Debbie Cox Boltan. Debbie has more than 30 years of experience in center-left politics, public policy, and nonprofit leadership. She's the founding CEO of New Deal, a unique national network of rising innovative stars and local elected Democrats that are working to expand opportunity for all Americans. She's also the host of an excellent podcast called An Honorable Profession, where she speaks with exceptional state and local leaders about their work and path into public service. And let me just tell you guys, there's a lot of very depressing podcasts that you can listen to. This podcast is often one of them. But Debbie's podcast really gives you something to be optimistic about. You'll hear us talk about that later in the episode. Some of you may remember Debbie. She's been on the show a couple of times, and she's in the race to become our very first five-timer, at which point we will proudly unveil an excellent purple jacket, SNL style. But until then, she's going to be on the show today to talk about Democrats and their record to run on. She's going to tell us about the New Deal Freedom Agenda and what it looks like to fight these races at the state and local level. So without any further ado, I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. I'm Hillary Lombard, and this is Moderate Party. Let's get started. Debbie, thank you for coming back on the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Lovely to see you, Hillary. I really appreciate you having me back.
Of course. I'm going to start with a whopper.
Okay.
So last time we spoke, we discussed how President Biden was able to outrun the Democratic Party brand, which at the time we both agreed was toxic. However, today his popularity is cratered, and whether it's fair or not is beside the point. Are you concerned with whether Democrats will be able to outrun an unpopular president?
So I'm going to answer that in a couple different ways. I'm not sure that the popularity of the president today is where the popularity of the president is going to end up when we get to election day. So I will start with that premise. So I am actually heartened a little bit, to be honest with you, about where Democrats have been over the last couple years and the last couple cycles. I think people are frustrated and upset generally. It has been a bummer of a few years for the American people and globally as well. We grew up in this like extended period of peace and prosperity, which I think we got really used to. If you look over history, it's actually not historically what has always been. So we are in a tougher time than a lot of us have experienced ever in our lives. So I get why people are mad. I get why people are taking on the president. When you look at like actually voters and how Democrats have done, even with people taking out how they feel on presidential approval ratings, whether it was the midterms where you saw Democrats do really well against election deniers across the country, had a much better night than people expected 2 years ago. And then even in the off-year elections, when people went to the ballots, things like choice, even in ruby red states, people turned out to protect a woman's right to choose in places like Kansas and Kentucky and Virginia, and Democrats outperformed again. And there's even a special election. I was just talking to a friend in Florida. People might not know of a legislative race in the last couple of weeks in Florida where the Democrat surprised everyone and did well. So I think that there's a mismatch of what we're seeing in the sentiments and people's approval ratings of the president. And then we haven't even talked about the approval ratings of the person we might run against. So I'm concerned. Of course, I'm concerned. We are nervous by nature, Democrats. But I think we've got a really good record to run on. I'm incredibly proud of this president and this administration, what they've actually been able to accomplish. And we can talk about that. But the Democrats have a lot to be optimistic about.
Yeah, Democrats have pretty much gone undefeated since the last midterms. They've got a pretty solid record of winning.
We've had a record of winning. And look, again, I think that we're really early in this process. I just saw a poll that 63% of Democrats don't think Trump is going to be the nominee on the other side. That's a stunning statistic, right? So we are paying attention. We are paying attention to the ins and outs of Nevada and New Hampshire and Iowa and coming up in South Carolina. But I don't think the people are yet. And so I'm not sure that people really know that there's going to be a matchup here again, a rematch between Biden and Trump, and then what that looks like when that is a reality for people. And so again, I think that I'd rather be us than them in some ways about this. If they really do nominate Trump, an extreme person with 91 indictments, I mean, this is frankly kind of insane that they would do this.
It's wild.
It's hard to even say out loud, right? Because it's so wild. If you were like, what should we do as a party to have the best chance in the general election? Yeah, I know we should nominate Trump. That seems really crazy to me. And I know that I've heard Biden say in the past things like, don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative. And that's an important part of what will happen. But I also think he has a really impressive record to run on, right? They have had more success legislatively in a bipartisan way than practically any administration that I can think of, maybe ever. And from everything from the infrastructure bill to the CHIPS Act to the Inflation Reduction Act, those are all bipartisan pieces of legislation that were put forward that are really, truly helping people on the ground. As a Democrat, what I worry about is that people don't know that story. People aren't hearing it. People aren't believing it, maybe. I'd also point to the economy doing much better now than it was even months ago. The economy was doing well. Jobs were doing well. And unemployment was down. The stock market was doing well. It finally feels like the consumer confidence is rising as inflation is coming down, which is good for Democrats. And hopefully that continues. But there's clearly been a mismatch between what people are seeing on paper for the economy and how they're feeling about it. There's been a real bump in consumer confidence over the last couple months, like by 29% or something, the highest since like 1991. So I hope all those signs point to a better environment for the president going forward.
I think with the economy, that vibe check that you're talking about is really present, because we've talked about how we wish the Democrats would tighten up that economic message a little bit and really lead with it, Clinton style. And recent reporting has suggested that the Biden campaign is content to fight to a draw on the economy and then refocus on like democracy and other priorities. Do you think that's the right call for the campaign?
I don't know. I haven't seen that reporting, so I can't really speak to that reporting. But there is a really weird, longstanding belief that for a lot of people that Republicans have in a generic matchup done better on economic issues than Democrats have. When you just ask who you think's going to handle the economy better, that is crazy, and it's something we've got to fight for, because actually the record shows that Democrats have done incredibly well in power. Biden's created more jobs in his 4 years than the last three administrations combined. Of course, it was coming off COVID, but you know that we have. There's been a real pattern here of huge tax cuts under Republicans. The economy kind of craters. Democrats come in and rebuild it, build back up. Simon Rosenberg, I don't know if you know Simon, but has a really good stats on all of this and is out there talking about it a lot. The Biden-Harris administration has had a really deliberate strategy of investing in America. And rather than going back to the trickle-down tax cuts, they've said, no, we're not going to go that route, particularly coming off of COVID. We're going to really invest in the people and communities and families and jobs in America with dollars on the ground. And so through all of those alphabet soupy pieces of legislation, I mentioned some of already. That's happening, right? Takes a while, of course. The American Rescue Plan dollars, which was the first big package that passed, got a lot of money going straight to states and localities that they used to shore up small businesses and provide rent stability for people during COVID, and then also enable them to invest into things like housing and some other places that are going to be important longer term. So that was great. We saw those results, the number of childcare providers that were able to stay open, the number of jobs that were saved, the number of people who stayed in their homes. You know, those were all real results. And then some of the bigger piece of legislation that came later on the bipartisan stuff that's now investing in climate and energy costs for working family and in our infrastructure. It's actually been a pretty deliberate economic strategy to invest straight in America. And I'm hopeful that people will connect the dots and realize that was really brought to them by the Biden-Harris administration.
Yeah, it's crazy to me that you can receive a notice that your student loans have been forgiven, signed by Joe Biden, and you're like, I don't know, who did this for me? And it's just, regardless of how you feel about student loan forgiveness, like, Biden did that.
I agree. I was actually talking to the mayor of Milwaukee yesterday for my podcast, Honorable Profession.
Yep. Plug. Check the show notes.
Shameless plug. So I was asking him a little bit about what his experience had been with, and we were having this conversation about Wisconsin and how he thought Democrats were going to have to make the case. And he was saying, flat out, literally, he said Milwaukee would have been bankrupt had it not been for the American Rescue Plan. And that what he was able to do on some of those things I talked about, shoring up the small businesses, keeping people in homes, all those things, and then turn some of that money to some of those longer term issues like housing and childcare and other things. It was like a game changer. And I know it to be true because I'm talking to people around the country about it. But to your point, I think that there's still this disconnect on who should get credit.
Do you think that people are giving that credit to their state and local representative instead of to Biden at the top?
I'm not sure we're giving credit to anybody. You know, I don't think Republicans are getting credit for it. I mean, I am, you know, watching all of the people who voted against the federal government doing some of this money and then coming to try to take credit when the ribbon cutting at this new store or the plant or the new housing development's happening. I find that to be hard to swallow.
Pretty nice bridge you got there, Mitch McConnell.
It's shameless, right? Shameless. I think people are just trying to figure out how they're going to pay their mortgage and get the kids to school on time and get their loan paid off for school and all those things and just really aren't really paying attention. But Democrats are going to have to make the case if we're going to be successful in November, and we're going to have to connect those dots for people. And the good news is we don't have to make it up. The accomplishments are there, right? There's really a great record to run on if we can break through all the other noise.
Okay, so speaking of the noise, I would be remiss not to ask you about Biden's age. It's something that I've swatted away myself for a little while. I'm like, he's old, but he's handy. He's lively. It's fine. And then yesterday, the special counsel report came out and he's repeatedly characterized as an elderly man with significant memory lapses and problems. Do you think that Democrats were too quick to dismiss his age concerns? And what do you think that they should be doing about that now?
Let me say this. I'm super glad to see the president come out today really forcefully and address it. I think that we cannot not understand that it's on people's minds, right? I think you can't dismiss everybody saying that's not a legitimate question or not answering the question, right? Yeah, I do think this administration that led by this president has done remarkable things. And in fact, I think, and I really believe this, honestly, I believe that in his age, his wisdom, his experience, was a really important part of why we did so well coming out of COVID, why this economy, American economy, is doing so much better than other countries around the world and bringing inflation down. We don't talk about that enough as Democrats. I do think that we have a tendency sometimes, which is not good, whether it's on this issue or other issues, to like just look at people. If you ask that question, oh, you don't get it. Or you must be a Fox talking point person if you ask that question.
He's a boy of 12. What are you talking about?
You know, right? So that's a problem for Democrats. So I think Democrats have to address it head on. I think we should say, look, yeah, this is a person who would be the oldest president in history. But at the same time, he has a record to run on. He has the experience, wisdom, age that we need to tackle these really serious problems. I mean, I think he's got the temperament for what we need. The other thing that I want to say is that he is the thing that kind of makes me crazy about this conversation we're having about his age. He's running against a 77-year-old who I cannot imagine is in that great of health, given his proclivities. And he is, they were in high school at the same time. The one was a senior and one was a freshman. So this is, we are not running against, if this is, when we finally get down to who's actually running in this election, if this was Biden against a much younger person, I think that's a different conversation than Biden against Trump. I do think that his wisdom and age and experience have helped him. I also think it's really frustrating to me that this is a one-sided conversation about Biden and that no one seems to want to have the same conversation about Trump. Although Nikki Haley's trying, of course, to make the case.
If I can just sprinkle some frustration onto your frustration.
Please do.
Okay. So an NBC News poll said that 76% of voters are concerned about Biden's age compared to 61% that are concerned about Trump's legal challenges. And I don't know how that happens. Like, first off, it feels insane. Like, I don't know how Trump is doing a better job messaging his crimes than Biden is doing about messaging his age.
I think I hear you. That's ridiculous. And this goes to the heart of the problem and the predicament that we find ourselves in, this really bizarre political moment, I think, which is Trump has convinced some percentage of Americans, and it's a pretty high percentage. I don't think it's a majority percentage by any stretch, but it's a very high percentage, particularly Republicans, that all of the charges against him are trumped up, no pun intended, and a witch hunt, and has convinced people that government is the problem, that our institutions are broken, and this is a deliberate attempt to sow mistrust and distrust in democracy and in our government. And that's to me what keeps me up at night. That is just the tip of the spear, is this whole crazy notion that people were saying, as I was watching with four in the Republican primaries, and they were interviewing people saying that, would you vote for Trump if he's convicted of anything? And it was like, probably. And I'm like, and I think that I didn't see it. I know that President again came out this morning and made some remarks, and I think said something about, we're going to compare things. Let's talk about having a nominee for president who's been indicted 91 times. And that part frustrates me. And that part makes him sad and scared, because this is not, it's not even all federal charges. It's, you know, it's state-based charges. It's grand juries with people of their, you know, peers, random people in Atlanta have come together and looked at the evidence and said, yes, he needs to be indicted on this election interference stuff. And it's not just even one thing. It's election interference. It's the insurrection. It's, you know, actual assault charges. I mean, it is crazy. And I just can't imagine any other person that would be able to be in this position of actually being a potential candidate for president with this kind of stuff hanging over their head. And it just goes to, he was always right about this, that he could apparently shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and still be elected. It just speaks to how much a cult of personality the Republican Party has become. When I first came on the show, Hillary, and I love your show, and I'm so grateful for you continue to do it. You know, we were having this wonderfully fun conversation about the size and scope of government and the side, what's the role of taxes and what is the difference between the left and the right, which is so important, but it almost feels quaint to some extent right now, fast forwarding 2 years later, I'm not talking about Republicans writ large. There's plenty of Republicans I admire. There's plenty of Republicans that I think have done really great work with the Biden administration to pass bipartisan legislation. But we are in this really unique time where this Republican Party, where this nominee with his hold over the Republican Party is unlike anything I've ever seen. And it is a danger to this country in a way that you can't overstate. You know, I was talking about the Biden-Harris administration. I was talking about their bipartisan accomplishments. You contrast with that with, for example, the torpedoing of the immigration bill this week, where Trump said, nobody vote for this bill because we're not going to give Joe Biden a win in an election year. And we got this close to finally having bipartisan immigration reform in an issue that I think everyone agrees needs attention. But because he said, don't do it, don't give him a political win, all these people went for it, right? That's to me what is so frustrating, is that we don't really have two parties that are actually committed to governing right now. Too many people in Congress saying, yeah, I'm willing to go along with this because I'm scared not to. I'm scared what we'll do to my career. And that is a really dangerous place to be.
I think it's so scary because it's working. It seems like voters have divorced them, like their vote from policy outcomes. It doesn't have to work for me to vote for you. You can fail forward and I will continue to give my vote. And then with Democrats, they're like, if you exhale out of place, I will protest in your office. And I think that it's like asymmetric warfare in that way.
That's one of the things that's also really concerning to me is, and I, you know, there's a lot we could talk about. I mean, I think that the media didn't know how to cover Trump 8 years ago, 4 years ago. They don't know how to cover him now. Like, they just, so it's really, it's very hard. And there's this kind of whataboutism and I really literally saw as part of No Labels, someone from their leadership talking about the trying to make the case that the left and the right are the same and saying that, look, from the right, you had the insurrection on January 6th. And literally on the left, someone let John Fetterman wear shorts into the U.S. Senate. And I just have to go, that is not the same thing. I have been over the years critical of my own party when there's things that I don't agree with. And there's some messaging, certainly, that I don't agree with. The Democratic Party right now is led by a moderate president who's governed in a bipartisan way, the way he said he was going to. And to act like there's an equivalency between Joe Biden and what's happening with Donald Trump is like really insane. You don't have to like everything about Joe Biden. You don't have to like every policy he's done, but the equivalency thing is crazy. And I don't think the media knows how to cover that. It's infuriating. I just want to say the one other thing about Kian or the where you were saying about that it's working, which it is frustrating because you see poll after poll and you're like, are you just like what you were talking about with ages of bigger concern than 91 indictments, which is chaos and crazy. But I don't know if we know it's working. Right now, we're seeing what's happening in the Republican primary. It's certainly working, right? Stunning fact that Nikki Haley lost in Nevada when Trump wasn't on the ballot to no choice, right? I'd rather have none of the above.
Nevada was intent to just drive a car into a wall on that. But yes, I do still think it was staggering.
It was staggering. Come on. It was staggering. And that was eye-opening for me. So that's what we're hearing. That's what we think it's working. And again, but if we pause for a second and we go back to what happened in 22 and 23 at the ballot box, Democrats have done really well because I think people understand that there is a choice between really chaos and community, adult in the room. So I am hopeful that will extend when we get into the general election, because that really has been the trend. And there's nothing has changed from those fundamentals except to get better for Biden. That doesn't mean we rest on our laurels. This is a crazy time. I just am coming back from Washington, D.C. this week, where I was with several New Deal secretaries of state talking about what they're seeing on the ground and what they're worried about. And of course, across the board, I think in a bipartisan way, people are worried about artificial intelligence elections. There's plenty to worry about. So I'm not like, oh, don't worry about it. It's all going to be fine. It's been fine last couple of years. There's lots to worry about. But there's real things that could not just cut against Democrats, but just there's things to worry about in democracy as a whole. But I think that maybe there's this feeling like the race is already over. And that's just not true. People aren't paying attention yet. I think things will come into clearer focus once that really Trump is the nominee, Biden is the nominee, and then we'll talk about, we'll see where we are.
So Debbie, one of the reasons that I like talking to you so much is because I've got like all of this moderate energy, right? Like I'm just buzzing for the middle. But I think often people have a really difficult time articulating politically what it means to be a moderate in practice. But whenever I talk to you, you pretty much just break it down for me. Like, here's what we do. And I'm thankful. I feel so much better that it all feels more achievable. So I wanted to have you back on the show today so that you can tell me what we're going to do. The New Deal leaders just released a freedom agenda, and it's exactly that. It is how to be moderate in practice. So can you walk me and our listeners through what that is and what it entails? Just an overview.
So we released this agenda as part of our fall conference last November in concert with the New Democrat Coalition, which is a group of 100 moderate center-left Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives. So there's 100 of them, and then there's 200 of New Dealers across the country whose, you know, and your listeners may remember, are state and local elected officials below the level of governor who are center-left, pragmatic problem solvers who we invite to join New Deal and who we support on the governing side of things. And it was our attempt to put a message frame about where we think Democrats need to be centered when talking to voters. And to me and to us, the real thing that's at stake here and the real thing that's on the ballot is freedom. So we looked at the freedom through a number of different lenses. So obviously people right now think about freedom as a woman's right to choose or who you choose to love. And those are absolutely certainly at the top of the list of things that people, there's a real distinction between where the Democratic Party is right now and where the Republican Party is. But it's also, I think, a good lens to use to think about things like the freedom to pursue the American dream and what that means in terms of things like affordable housing and access to healthcare and access to good paying jobs and education. There's freedom to be safe in your communities, where I think you can put things like the Democrats' support for and championing common sense gun legislation in this country, or how to be safe from extreme weather events, and how Democrats have been the champions of investing in resiliency in the face of climate change. And then, of course, the other big one is democracy and the freedom to cast a ballot and be able to cast a ballot, which is actually even a worry in some places, and then have that ballot be counted. And so we thought that the freedom frame, when we're talking about the issues that Democrats care about this election cycle, is a really good way to make people understand what's at stake in this election.
What are you seeing manifest in the country that makes you think this is critical for right now?
Those, obviously, the freedom of the choice is obviously the most on a lot of people's minds, freedom of reproductive choice, freedom for reproductive health care. And obviously, this is coming in the wake of the Dobbs decision. And we've already seen how game changing that's been from an electoral perspective, of not just on the Democratic side, but across the aisle, in terms of women saying, no, we're not going to go backwards on and taking away a right that was given to us 50 years ago. I think that's obviously something people can understand. And if you look at what the Republicans' big issues have been, whether it's anti-choice, whether it's the book ban, whether it's we're not going to teach things in school like slavery, they have long wanted to own the freedom word. I feel like the freedom has been a word that Republicans have used a lot against Democrats. And I think that right now you've seen the hypocrisy of that, that a lot of their marquee issues that they've been talking about have been really the antithesis of freedom, just to name it, that's a few that I named there. And then I think that the nice thing about thinking about freedom, so there's those choices. And the nice thing about thinking about freedom is that some of the other Democratic priorities, like I said, taking climate change seriously, investing in climate change, which has not been a Republican priority at all for the most part, also can fit in that frame. Things like lead pipes and clean drinking water and clean air. That's all, if you think about it, part of having the life we all want to live and to be able to prosper and be free to prosper in this country. And so I think that putting some of the Democratic priorities into that frame helps people understand why those things matter a little bit better than just talking. Democrats, as we have talked about in the past, have a bad habit of talking about legislation and talking about not always leading with our values. Let me say it that way. So I think that what I liked about what we did with the new Dems is to put it in value language of like, why are these things important to us? Why is freedom of opportunity important to us? Why is freedom for a safe community important to us? As opposed to just talking about this piece of legislation or this effort on affordable housing. It really fits into this broader frame.
I was pleasantly surprised to see the community was listed as one of the three main pillars in the agenda. Can you talk me through what the thinking was in making it so prominent?
I think there's a couple things about that. I mean, I really do feel like at the end of the day, that's the choice we're being given. It feels like what's happening right now is that people are trying to divide us, right? And not bring us together. And community is such an important value of mine. I think it's a really critical underpinning value of the Democratic Party. When I was at the DLC for all those years, getting my bona fides in the center of space, if people remember, opportunity, responsibility, and community were the things that we talked about a lot back then and when President Clinton was running for office. And I think that now we have democracy being added to that. But that community to me is just a pillar of what we've always believed as Democrats, which is that we are stronger together, that we believe that a rising tide lifts all boats, and that we have to make sure that everybody has access to things like housing, like healthcare, and all those things. And then, so that was a big part of it. And then the other thing that to me is, again, newer when we think about community is the community safety piece of it. I'm a big believer that we've got to invest in law enforcement, support policing, and make sure that people feel safe. And then I think that goes hand in hand with that is common sense gun reform. And I really believe that most Americans are fed up with the fact that we can't do more together. We've seen the polls. The vast majority of Americans believe in common sense gun reforms on things like background checks and maybe limiting the ammunition and that this is a real extreme group that's trying to fight against it. So I think there's just a lot of things under community that bring the country together. And it really is the opposite of kind of what we're seeing right now on some of these issues that we tried to bring forward is really just chaos. Frankly, it is chaos versus community, if you will. So that's thinking behind it.
Yeah, I would really like to see Democrats get louder on community safety and like support for law enforcement in particular. I think that the pendulum, it kind of swings both ways. And I think that there were a lot of areas in law enforcement that needed critique, but I think that I'm also excited at the potential the Democrats are going to get more supportive of law enforcement as well. Because I think particularly in blue cities, there's a really damaging narrative and often an even more damaging reality about how dangerous and chaotic these cities can be.
Well, interestingly, I know that our friends over at Third Way did a big study on this at one point where they were showing that actually it's red state policies in many places that are leading to some of the spikes in crime where those exist. But no, I agree with you. Look, I think we can talk and chew gum at the same time, right? That's another frustration I have, but going back to our earlier conversation about where we are politically, it's like everybody wants the things to be black and white. And if you're not in the right place, you're canceled or whatever. And it's, these are really complicated issues. And it's perfectly reasonable to say, look, I think that the police, as we have thought about policing for many decades, could be restructured in a way where we have people like mental health providers responding to some things that are not criminal, or we should be thinking about rehabilitation and addiction and not just law enforcement in terms of responses to crime. So that may require us to think differently about how we structure police programs. We clearly, you've got a problem where there have been just horrific things happen in this country to citizens at the hands of police. Let's talk about training. Let's talk about why that is and figure that out. At the same time, we need to invest in police officers. These are not contradictory things. And to act like somehow that those are, you have to be on either side of that issue is one example of what frustrates me about these are, and again, goes back to, I'll be a broken record today. And I'm sorry about that because I just am fired up about it. But which leads to me to be like, why does there's not even a conversation about this election and what needs to happen? Because, and that this is not a nuance of these really, you know, lovely things we used to talk about, the size of government. We've got somebody, you know, a party that's trying to not govern and to create chaos. And we've got a party that's talking about these really complicated nuanced issues. And we need adults in the room who are talking about how to govern. And there's no choice this time around.
I think that the issues that you're raising with law enforcement being able to hold two things to be true at the same time becomes particularly true at a state and local level, because I think that it's like at a federal level, you make a mess and then the states have to clean it up. And I think that on rhetorical issues, it's like the Democratic Party, as an example, will say, this is what we believe about criminal justice. But then in a community, it's much more nuanced than that. Like, you can't just implement an idea. You can only implement a policy, right? So I think in a lot of ways, the states become a battleground between our values and the actions that are required to implement them. And I'm curious how you think that a state and local leader responds to that tension.
I guess, so like, state and local leaders have a unique opportunity to put those values into practice, actually, that I'm not necessarily see them as a tension. I feel like that's particularly the local level. I'm thinking mayors in particular, because they can do things by executive order and things like that. But I can name multiple mayors, but I'll start with Tim Keller in Albuquerque, because he just is one of the first people to do it. But he was one of the first people, in the light of what was happening after George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many of the other horrific things that happened, to restructure his police department with a fourth branch of response. So it was the medical EMT, whatever, the fire, the police. And he added a fourth branch, which was mental health responders, so that you weren't always responding to a disturbance or a person who needed help, addiction, whatever it was, with the kind of the criminal lens, right? And then he did that in all kinds of other police departments and first responder departments, systems did the same thing across the country. So I feel like, you know, I do feel like I echo your point 100% that like state and local leaders are on the front lines of so much right now. And currently that's been, there has been a gridlock in Washington, no doubt about it. The Supreme Court has devolved a bunch of things down to the states, choice obviously being the first and foremost, a woman's right to choose. Democracy, another big one, right? There were, I forget, hundreds of pieces of legislation last cycle, or last legislative session, I'm sorry, on voting, right? And what's the, how are we going to put those values into practice? We saw what happened during COVID. Now with elections, the integrity of our elections are under attack. We actually put out a plug in for this too, if you don't mind, but a democracy playbook last year with our secretaries of state, the state legislators and others, with 40 ideas that state and local leaders, regardless of party, could implement heading into the 2024 elections. And everything from things that I think have resounding bipartisan support, things like protecting poll workers, prosecuting people if there is election interference, making sure that you are testing your equipment and having a real transparent process, making it easier to find information online, all kinds of things to both restore trust in the process or to continue to have trust in the process, depending on your perspective, and just making sure that the elections are secure and safe. Anyway, all of those things are happening at the hyper-local level, of course, state legislatures in cities and counties across the country. So I just feel like there's just so much exciting stuff going on that doesn't get the attention. There was a lot of bad stuff that happened in legislatures in terms of voting and trying to restrict access to ballots or claw back on things like absentee voting, which had been very successful until this kind of crazy new lens with the 2020 election. But there were also a lot of really good things that happened in Michigan and New Mexico and Minnesota, where people in Connecticut, where people expanded access to voting, made some protections stronger. And that's the stuff that just doesn't get covered because we always like to cover the bad things and not the good things. I'm excited about what's happening across the country.
So I take your point that at a local level, you can apply your values. And I do like your optimism, but just to cover some more bad news.
Are you cranky today?
Hey.
Yeah, no, it's hard not to be, is what I mean. I hear you. There's a lot of bad news to cover.
I guess I have a lot of empathy or sympathy, rather, for state and local leaders when you look at an issue like migration. Nationally, or the Democratic brand is very supportive of migration. And then you look at Congress and they can't make a decision or pass a bill about what we're going to do about the border. So the crisis perpetuates and the people that have to deal with that are the states and cities, right? So you'll see like Denver, Chicago, New York, they're having an increase in their migrant population and their city doesn't have the infrastructure to support it. So like, how do you think that state and local leaders respond to stuff like that?
That's obviously affecting some cities more than others. I mean, immigration is an issue. Whether it's affecting people in terms of numbers or not, it's an issue because it's on the front page of the news. So wherever you are in this country as a Democratic elected official or any elected official, you need to talk to people about immigration for sure.
Yeah.
So there's the messaging and the policy making, and then there's the reality on the ground in some cities. But you're absolutely right. Of course, this busing stunt, it's so un-American, to be honest with you, right? It's so un-American to use people as a human base, as a publicity stunt. But the point is that there are these now cities that are really struggling with needing the more resources to house, clothe, feed people who are coming into their cities, as much as it impacts state and local leaders who across the board, our leaders have tried to respond with compassion and finding public services, a lot of public private partnerships I've seen of trying to work with the faith community and others to get people what they need. The sad part about immigration is that it really is one of those things that's, from a policy perspective, is really a federal piece of legislation that's needed. And I'm really sad that, like we were talking about earlier, that we got pretty close this week to a bill that I didn't love. The Democrats gave up a lot in that bill. There were a lot of pieces of that building the wall and, you know, things that I'm not sure are necessary, but it really truly was a bipartisan compromise by Republican and Democratic senators. And it was really hard. I was teasing you, but I mean, listen, it's really hard not to be cranky about what's happening because it feels like we're being let down. But it's frustrating because it's like, we send you to Washington to legislate, right? I guess for me, that's why I'm in this business. And that's why I keep at it. I'm lucky that I'm working with state and local leaders who really are able to get some things done, you know, more readily at this point than is happening in Washington. But I also think that it has nothing to do almost with the fact that it's like, oh, that's just politicians. That's just how politics are. That's what's frustrating to me is I actually think most people go into politics for the right reasons. I think there's been an effort to undermine elected officials, undermine government for so long. So now we have this kind of very distrusting, mistrusting public running headlong into a person, frankly, Donald Trump and others who are feeding on that and trying to exasperate it and sow more chaos and sow more dysfunction, sow more gridlock. I guess I just continue to try to put one foot forward because I just feel like, what's the alternative, right? If we're not trying to make it better, the alternative is so scary, right? It is so scary. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but it's just something on my mind right now because I'm trying not to, as frustrated as I am with like what happened this week and as frustrated as I am with what is happening in Congress, I'm trying not to bash members of Congress because I do feel like that's part of the problem, right? And I do think that there's a lot of people in there that want to make it better and that the system and the dynamics right now are really pulling against that. And we've got to get back to how to hold them accountable in a good way, not a bad way. Like not to say we're sending you there to do nothing. That's what we want you to do. We want you to stick it to the other side and stick it to the other team. Like I want people to be like, we're sending you to Congress to get stuff done. And if you don't get stuff done, we're going to vote people out that will work across the aisle, that will find common ground. That's what I want to get back to. And I don't have high hopes for that in 2024, but I feel like that reckoning has to be coming because it's what I really honestly believe that's where most people in America are. I just think we're getting run over by the extremes right now.
But they'll tire themselves out, I hope. Like a baby, you got to let them cry it out. I don't know. In the spirit of banishing my cranky mood, can you tell me a couple of things that are happening at a state and local level that you feel really excited about?
Yeah, I will. One is how many new people are coming into the system. That's something that I feel really happy about. I feel like with everything we're talking about, like it's so, it would be easy to believe that people are like, why would I ever run for office? And that, you know, that would not be an unreasonable thing to think. Like, why would I put myself out there? It's so hard to be an elected official and everybody's so mad all the time and everybody's taking it out on us. We've had a bunch of leaders, New Deal leaders who have experienced terrible things from death threats on down, right? So anyway, it's a hard time to be an elected official. But with that said, on the happy side, I have been really heartened by the fact that people are still stepping up to run for office. And in fact, almost because of what's happening, right? People are feeling like this is they see what's going on. They want to make a difference. They want to be part of the solution. And so they're stepping up and people, young people, women, people of color, real diverse set of people running for office. People who have been around in office a long time, but didn't know what they signed up for, right? And now they are dealing with the new realities. People that are coming in office right now know that. And they're like, yeah, that's why I'm doing it. I feel like we more than ever need people, good people, to run for office. So that's making me happy. And maybe briefly, I'll just say one more time that I feel like another thing that's making me happy maybe is on the democracy front. People, we talk a lot, and that could be a whole other show you could do with somebody about whether people care about democracy enough to save it, right? And so therefore, from where I sit, should we be talking about democracy as a political issue? Do people know what that means? Is a winning message? But what I have been heartened by is like watching Democratic and Republican secretaries of state come together to say, we're going to hold the line together, right? I'm seeing legislation get passed, like I said, not just having to bat back bad things, but passing legislation to enshrine voting rights and making the process more transparent so people have faith in it. And then maybe the ultimate validation of that is so far, knock on wood, seeing at the ballot box, even if people aren't talking about it going into elections, I feel like people are voting that way, at least have been in the last couple cycles, to say, yeah, I get this, right? I'm going to vote. I'm not going to vote for an election denier as Secretary of State. So that's inspiring. Now, there's plenty of election deniers at the local offices, which scares me heading into 24. But that's, if you want me to say it on an optimistic end note, I will say that's another thing that is making me feel some hope.
So how do people stay in touch with you? How do we follow the Freedom Agenda?
We love to have people join this movement of people trying to just solve problems and advocate for and champion good leaders with good ideas. So they can find us at www.newdealleaders.org. And you can find a copy of the Freedom Agenda there. And keep listening to Hillary, of course, because she's doing great stuff. And then also add to your podcast list, An Honorable Profession, where we talk to state and local leaders around the country about what got them into office. And maybe that's one of the reasons I have so much hope, is I get to have those conversations on a weekly or biweekly basis. And those give me hope, too. So hope you listen to that as well.
Debbie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Hillary. I really appreciate you having me on. I so love your perspective and our conversations. I'm so grateful for you having me back on again.
Absolutely. You're welcome back anytime. But specifically, one more time, because then we're rolling out the jacket.
I'm very excited about this. Yeah. We're definitely doing it.
If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to like, rate, review, follow, subscribe, do all the stuff. I love doing the show. I love getting to know you guys. And when you do that, it helps spread the word and get more people to listen. If you have any thoughts, comments, or suggestions, you're always welcome to email me at talk@moderatepartypodcast.com. And with that, I'll see you soon. Stay safe, you guys.